Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. 8:06 on this Wednesday morning. It's January 14th. Currently, we've got 26 degrees here under mostly sunny skies. Heber City has got some hazy sunshine. Right now, 17 degrees. Again, that cold air gets trapped into those inversions, along with all of the pollution. Anyway, on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Happy Wednesday, KPCW listeners. We're looking at lots of sunshine out there for us today. For Park City, we're going to see those highs climbing into the mid to upper 40s. Meanwhile, in the Heber Valley, watch out for those hazy skies to redevelop out there with those temperatures upper 40s to right around 50 degrees. As we go into your Thursday, look for temperatures to drop down into the teens and 20s to kick off the morning. Thursday afternoon will feature lots of sunshine up towards Park City with highs in the mid 40s. We'll see those highs again in the upper 40s to near 50 in the Heber Valley with those hazy skies returning. Moving into your Friday, high pressure is firmly anchored over the Beehive State, and that means we're not going to be tracking much in the way of any significant changes. We'll see more sunshine up towards Park City with those highs in the low to mid 40s. We'll be in the mid to upper 40s for highs for us in the Heber Valley with those hazy skies once again making a return. We may see a little bit of a wind shift that develops as we go into the upcoming weekend. That could help disperse the haze out of the skies around the Heber Valley. Overall, though, we'll stay with that sunshine, so no real precipitation chances. Morning low temperatures will dip down into the 20s both Saturday and Sunday mornings, and we'll see those high temperatures climbing into the mid 40s for us in the Park City area with highs in the upper 40s in the Heber Valley. Heading into next week, you guessed it, we're still underneath that ridge of high pressure, even though it will not be as strong or dominant. We'll still see plenty of sunshine out there across the area. Morning low temperatures in the 20s for your Monday and Tuesday morning. We'll see those highs climbing into the mid 40s for us in Park City for next Monday and Tuesday, with highs climbing into the upper 40s to near 50 in the Heber Valley. Overall, this ridge of high pressure, this dry, stagnant weather pattern will stay in place until at least towards the end of next week. There are some signs by the time we get towards the end of next week and heading into the last week of January, we may start to see some changes and a more active weather pattern. But of course, that's still 7 to 10 days out at the earliest from happening. Let's look at your latest forecast for the Wasatch Back on ABC 4 Meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be checking in with State Senator for District 20, that's Summit and Wasatch Counties, among others. Ron Winterton will have a preview of this year's legislative session. That starts on Tuesday. Park City Attorney Margaret Plain, along with Deputy City Manager Heather Snedden, will be previewing this week's City Council meeting, including a consent agreement that could allow construction to proceed on an 11,000-square-foot home in Old Town. Then stay tuned for the Mountain Life. Today's guests include Brandeis University President Arthur Levine, discussing the question whether students still need a college degree or is higher education overdue for complete reinvention. He'll answer that question, and as that has dominated his research over some 40 years. Then fertility expert and nutritionalist Rachel Swanson discusses her new book, Trine, a science-based plan to optimize your fertility. All of that coming up on The Mountain Life, heard every Wednesday at 9 a.m. No report here from the Avalanche Center, but I'll read you the report that upper elevation slopes have a moderate danger with two avalanche types. First, large dangerous avalanches may still be triggered in steep, rocky, and shallow terrain facing west, north, and east. These hard slabs are failing 2 to 5 feet deep on a persistent weak layer. And second, watch for stiff slabs of wind-drifted snow on those west, south, and eastern aspects. These drifts are common on cross-loaded features and may break above you. Avalanche danger low elsewhere. Small but predictable wet-loose avalanches could release during the day on those sunny slopes with daytime warming. Again, if you need more information, know before you go, check out the report for yourself at utahavalanchecenter.org. Park City Council may end years of litigation this week over billionaire Matthew Prince's planned home overlooking Old Town. KPCW's Christine Weller reports a consent agreement is possible under a 2025 law, but neighbors say it won't end there.
The Park City Council will consider a consent agreement regarding Matthew Prince's Treasure Hill home plans during its meeting Thursday. The agreement would resolve ongoing disputes over land use decisions and award Prince the building permit he needs to finally build an 11,000-square-foot mansion above historic Main Street. The consent agreement is allowed under a bill lawmakers passed late in the 2025 general session. SB 262 allows city councils to bypass planning commissions to settle litigation with property owners regarding land use decisions. Prince is the CEO of the cybersecurity company Cloudflare and owns the Park Record. Prince first submitted applications for permits to build a single-family home, outdoor pool, and terrace on the King Road property in 2022. What followed was a spate of city department-level appeals and lawsuits that have challenged the planned home's height, floor area, roof design and slope, parking area, and whether its design meets Park City's historic standards. Litigation against the home plans was first initiated in 3rd District Court in August 2024 by Prince's downhill neighbors, Eric Herman and Susan Fredston Herman. If the council adopts the agreement, Prince and the city would agree to ask the court to dismiss the pending case. The Hermans, however, dispute whether the lawsuits could be resolved under the consent agreement.
A consent agreement won't stop the court hearing unless all parties agree to stop the court hearing.
The Hermans say they want their day in court, which is scheduled for January 29th. Prince did not respond to KPCW's request for comment Tuesday. Under the agreement, Prince agrees to accept the 24 conditions in the Historic District Design Review, add landscaping to minimize the home's visual impact, make road safety improvements, and cover the cost of future legal challenges related to the three lawsuits. The council will meet at 5:30 p.m. in City Hall Thursday. Locals can attend in person or watch online. Park City Municipal is a financial supporter of KPCW. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
The 2026 Utah General Legislative Session starts Tuesday, January 20th, and will run through March 6th. It's a 45-day session that ultimately results in hundreds of bills being passed, as well as next year's state budget. That starts July 1st. On the phone with a preview of some of the topics this year, I have State Senator Ron Winterton. He serves as the senator for District 20, which serves the residents of Summit and Wasatch County. Good morning, Senator. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. How are you?
Doing well. Thanks so much. So this is the third year of your second four-year term, and you have re-upped for another 4 years, facing only one opponent, Annette McRae from the Utah Forward Party. I guess just taking a look back at what you've done so far, what are you most proud of your time in office to date?
Well, that's a really good question. I think back, and my objective is to support your local elected officials, and so going back in the previous years, we've helped stabilize the film industry in Summit County. We ended up passing a rural film incentive bill, which brought production back to the county and to other parts of the state, which that industry kind of picked up and left when they lost the Yellowstone contract, and now we've got that back. So that's one thing we've helped. We're always looking at housing crisis and what other legislators have proposed to do is not good for the rural parts or hasn't addressed it, and so we plot for that. Summit County has done a really good job in trying to address that, but again, some of the legislators seem to be heavy-handed in how they want to administer their opinions, and that hasn't been good. So in some ways, it's an uphill battle for us to fight to make sure that our voice is being heard. We've accomplished quite a bit. We're still working at looking forward into the 2034 Olympics, and transportation is a big concern there. UDOT's looking into that, trying to see where we can jump some of the projects ahead and not wait to 34, because even after the Olympic is gone, we will still have the impacts. And so we're looking for residents and the best way to do that.
Okay. Well, speaking of the film industry, I was not going to bring this up until the very end of the interview, but I do want to talk about it, because the Sundance Film Festival was certainly an event that brought millions of tax dollars into the state, providing numerous jobs, branding Park City, of course, as a cultural hub around the world. Did the state blow it by letting Sundance move out of state? I mean, we certainly had the comments by one state senator and some speculation leaking the decision to Utah's conservative politics, particularly the Pride flag ban, may have pushed Sundance over the edge.
Yeah, and you know, that could be said. On the other hand, it is independent. They can do what they want. It's sad that to see them, you know, after this year leave. And on the state level, there are measures going moving forward trying to replace that with some other film festival that we would be able to continue, you know, a tradition of having the film festival there. So I'm not happy about it, but I don't have a say in it. Okay. That was, you know, the Sundance Film Festival people that decided to go elsewhere. And as we looked at when politics start playing into what goes on locally, when the outdoor retailers went to Colorado, it wasn't the same for them, and they didn't do well, and they came back. And so to try to make a statement by doing stuff like that, I think they hurt their own industry. So I hope to see, you know, them not that I'm wishing them well over there. I want to see them come back. But in the meantime, I think that we can do a good job in replacing what we have going.
Okay, move on. The budget, of course, that's the legislature's number one job, is approving a budget. Most of that money, as we know, spent on education, transportation, and public health and welfare. This year, the governor's recommended budget totals $30.7 billion. That's down from the current year, $30.8 billion, basically flat. The Trump administration's Big Beautiful Bill Act affected state revenues to the tune of about $500 million. So how is that shortfall being made up?
Well, we're going to be very flat. They've already told us we don't have any extra money, that a request for appropriations for projects probably won't be entertained or taken serious because we just don't have it to give out. The Big Beautiful Bill had some cuts in it, in which it's a pass-through to the state of Utah. So right now, we've already committed to do another income tax reduction on state taxes, and that alone puts us, you know, we're talking about we're going to have a difference of about $2 million just in taxes there that are probably going to be unseen from the public. And so we're starting with a deficit now.
Okay. So, I guess so. So am I going to see that income tax reduction?
You should see it on your paychecks. But, you know, okay, for us to say, well, here's the money we gave back to you, it's already been factored in, and the Big Beautiful Bill factored in another cut that you'll see. So we don't have that money as in the past to appropriate somewhere else. So
okay,
it will be very lean this year.
Even with that flat budget, Governor Cox recommending a 4.2% boost to the weighted pupil unit. This is basically the funding block for school operations, teacher salaries. Can you get behind that increase?
Yeah, we've always been very supportive. I was just looking, and over the last 6 years, I mean, when you look nationally, Utah's number four in pupil weight as what we spend per pupil. And so we're doing really good that way. A lot of the things, you know, the local property taxes, between 70% of your property tax goes to the school district. And that's never factored in to what the state accounts for the WPU. So when you factor in what goes locally, we're right there at the top for education. But I am very supportive of anything that we do that will help, you know, raise that amount up on education.
Yeah. Now, are you in favor of capping what local school boards can tax their residents?
You know, that's a discussion that I am highly motivated to do, because look down in Wasatch County. I mean, they're building a new high school. They went to the people and said, we need a bond for this high school, and they rejected it, and yet they still did it. And so I have a hard time. If we can't justify why we're raising the taxes, they shouldn't be raised.
And we're also seeing that at North Summit as well. They're going through with the lease revenue bonds to build a new school there as well.
Perhaps. Yeah, and so you got to have the discussion, and unless they can justify it, I'm not in favor of increasing taxes. And so to cap it would be one way from the state level that we can try to control what your property taxes are.
Yeah, and that gets me to the issue of local control, because we hear this every year. You say Republicans, I mean, they're the party of, you know what, let local places do, you know, what is good for them. And yet, now we're talking about, well, we know better, and no, you know, we're going to cap you, Park City School District, on taxes you can charge. We don't elect the school board members if we don't like what they're doing. I guess it's like, so where does local control start and where does it end? Because it really feels like the Utah legislature says that they're the ones in charge of local control, not local government.
Well, I have to agree with you a bit, because I'm a local government guy, and meeting with your elected officials last night over in Colville, this was a subject that came up, and I am big on it. We don't know what every community wants or is best for them, and at the state level, to make a bill that one size fits all is not good policy. I'm against that. Sometimes they keep saying, well, we need to help them because they don't know about, take for instance, housing. So we're going to make laws that will force them to get the end result we want to see. But that's not best locally. So you're right. Local is always better, and we need to always keep that in mind. And some of the majority of the state legislatures have no experience in local government, and they think that from the top down's best. I do not agree with that.
Well, I appreciate, I think we all do, hearing that, because I'm going to just rattle off a number of items that the state legislature has decided it knows better. Of course, right now, what was it? The bill just last year, you know, that allows settlement agreements, and the city council here in Park City considering one tomorrow that would allow Utah's richest man to build a home the size of our city hall in an historic district where historic lots are 25 feet by 75 feet long. I mean, lawmakers continue to threaten Park City. Well, we'll take away the historic district, or we're going to weaken local historic district, or we're going to weaken local building authority. And I mean, this threat comes up. It has come up for several years. I mean, Senate Bill 271 in 2023, the bill that prohibited local government from regulating fractional ownership and overreach in Park City's eyes. House Bill 37 in 2025 that would have barred cities from imposing historic preservation requirements on buildings built after 1991. Senate Bill 340 in 2025 that could provide exemptions for wealthy individuals to bypass city building codes for security improvements. I mean, the list goes on. And again, what can you do? You've been there now a while. I mean, how can you convince your fellow lawmakers to let local government do their job?
It is very frustrating in the fact that they still see us. We're a rural county, and when you look at the legislators that represent the rural parts of the state, when you look at our numbers, they're very few, but yet we can represent two-thirds of the state. And when they keep doing stuff like this, and I've worked with both your city council, your county council, and I plead with them all the time. You have to give me heads up. If you see a bill that you have problems with or it's not good, you've got to inform me so that I can help you in navigating some kind of a better bill or to get something out of it. We did that last year on the redistricting bill on the county council. And it's heavy-handed. Mm-hmm. And I keep telling my colleagues, you can't do this. And that particular bill, they didn't even consult me until the morning that we were running the bill. And I told them they were out of place. You didn't even consult me. It affected two of my counties, and you don't want to even give me the courtesy of telling me what's going on. And so they do. They're heavy-handed in a lot of ways, and they think they can do it because they are the legislature. So am I, but they don't take into account how it affects our lives personally.
Okay.
And so we do. I mean, I holler. I mean, you've got great representation. We've had a good working relationship. And so if I can't do it, I make sure I can get them in and talk to the bill sponsor or at least be heard on their complaints.
All right. As you know, we have a crisis facing the Great Salt Lake and the Colorado River. Governor Cox proposing to spend an additional $5 million to secure water for the lake, also proposing another $5 million more to pay farmers to not grow some crops and send the water down the Colorado River. You understand how this works. I mean, is $5 million going to make a difference? I mean, it just feels like a drop in the bucket.
You're absolutely right. Ideas like that take money, but I don't know that you can throw enough money at it to solve that issue. And when you start talking about the Colorado River, we have water shares over there, good water rights over there, but it takes money to develop those. And until you develop those, you can't just move stuff around on paper and think you're going to end up in the Great Salt Lake with water. It doesn't work that easy. So, To me, the governor's proposal is very short-sighted. Yeah, it's an effort of trying to do something, and we've worked at the Great Salt Lake now for the past 4 years, and they've asked us not to run water bills because we've got to see what is currently on the books, if it's working or not, or do we need to tweak it. We keep coming up with ideas and passing more legislation, but it's got legislation on top of legislation, which we don't know if it's doing any good or not. We've got to take a breather, and we are concerned about the Great Salt Lake, and I don't know the recipe to make water, but that seems to be out of our control. We can do measures of conservation and then funneling unused water there also.
With the incredible amounts of water it takes to fuel data tech centers and AI, are we putting families and farmers at risk in order to have more computing power?
Absolutely not. That is one of the biggest concerns. And as you go through the checklist of what data centers need, along with a lot of electricity, they need water. And we're not going to put them over our residents. That is priority. And we do have some bills that will state that, and we're not going to go after data centers at the cost of our residents.
I'm about out of time here, and I hope we get to check in with you during the session. But I, real quick,
yes.
We're hearing about talk about expanding the state Supreme Court. I'm guess do you favor that, and do you favor electing judges, which seems to be being considered because some Republican leaders don't like recent rulings from the state Supreme Court, and it sounds like they feel like the legislature can't control the state Supreme Court, which is crazy because they shouldn't be. I mean, they should be, should be a separation of power. So do you support expanding the Supreme Court?
I'm listening to the arguments both for and against it, and yeah, the population says that we've grown enough that we probably need to. What's the caseload? When you look at the caseload, they're not as productive as other states. When you see how many cases they take on or their workload, they're not doing terrific. So to say that, well, they're overworked and we've got to give them relief, that doesn't settle with me. As far as electing judges, I have colleagues in Texas and said that's terrible. You don't want to do it because it becomes a political thing instead of, you know, they should be outside of the political arena. Their job is to interpret the law, not make law. And so I'm still out. They haven't made an argument to convince me that that's what we need to do.
All right, Ron, I'm going to let that go. How do people contact you to give them a piece of their mind?
they can look at the state website, but my email is just rwinterton@le.utah.gov. I do have an intern. She monitors my emails and my texts during the session, try to be very responsive. Actually, a little note there is that I was visiting with her last week. They signed it randomly at us. She is from Park City. So some of you might want to reach out to her, and I can't tell you her maiden name, but it is Caitlin Stansfield, and looking forward to getting to know her and working with her this session.
All right. Sure appreciate your time this morning, Senator. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks.
That's State Senator Ron Winterton. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. The Park City Council started off 2026 with a bang. In addition to yesterday's interviews of the 10 applicants looking to be named to the unexpired council term of Ryan Dickey, the council will make some decisions to move the senior center along, a discussion on the legislative platform before the legislative session starts next week, and a proposed consent agreement to settle the ongoing lawsuits and possibly allow construction of the 11,000-square-foot home in Old Town. In the studio to discuss, City Attorney Margaret Payne. She's joined by Deputy City Manager Heather Snedden. Thanks. Good morning. And thanks for being here.
Good morning.
Again, a beefy meeting and something that stands to impact the future of Old Town Park City. So let's just get to that first. The consent agreement between Park City and Matthew Prince's LLC, Pesky Porcupine. The staff report notes that the execution of this consent agreement would settle three court cases involving Pesky Porcupine and Park City Municipal. But what about the third party in this matter? I mean, the Prince's neighbors, the Fredston Hermans, who filed two of these three lawsuits that you're looking to settle. As you know, Margaret, consent requires a yes from everyone involved. And according to the Hermans, this agreement doesn't do that.
Great question. And I think that the parties are going to have different perspectives on what the consent agreement does. I'd like to back up a little bit because I think there's been a lot of reporting and a lot of narrative that the city council's ability to resolve land use disputes is new. That's inaccurate. The council's always had the authority to resolve disputes like this. It just hasn't been in the black letter law. And there's lots of common law, and by that I mean case law, talking about local governments settling disputes like this. And so now we have legislation that specifically gives it a name, and that's this, quote, consent agreement. And the legislation isn't tested. And so I think the parties disagree about what the result of this consent agreement would be, and that's okay.
Well, then change the name, because again, we know that consensual agreement requires yes from every party. And that does not do this.
Well, the City Council and Pesky Porcupine are agreeing to resolve the dispute, and the City Council is exercising, if they choose to approve it, and that's an open question, right? This is on their agenda, and they're considering it. But if the City Council decides to approve it, what they are doing is exercising their policy judgment to affirm what the Planning Commission approved, affirm what the appeal panel approved, and reinstate the planning director's HDDR approval. And that's within their policy determination, and what appeal rights stem from that is yet to be seen.
Well, and, but again, I am so hung up on the word consent, because again, consent means agreement amongst all parties, and you don't have that. So maybe if you change the name of the agreement, then maybe that would be a little bit easier to swallow.
But well, we could talk to the legislature about that. We didn't use those words. We're just following the law.
So if the city and Mr. Prince can agree to resolve the appeal themselves without the agreement of the Fredston Hermans, how does the city ensure that the Fredston Hermans' statutory right to appeal has any real meaning?
Well, I think that gets at the heart of your initial question, Leslie. The parties have an appeal right in land use decisions by virtue of the statute. So this isn't a broader concept where people have a fundamental right to go into court. It's an appeal right that's granted by statute. And so I think the question you're asking is whether this statutory settlement power implicates the rest of the statutory scheme that allows someone to have an appeal. And the agreement that's currently proposed and that council will consider is drafted to let the council replace the Board of Adjustments decision by reinstating the HDDR approval. And that's a policy determination. And again, what appeal rights stem from that will probably be disputed.
And yeah, and I'm going to get on to that in a little bit. But I guess some residents worrying that this does set a precedent that if a developer or wealthy individual applies enough pressure outside the normal process, that the city may be feel compelled to make concessions to protect its broader authority. So what's your response to that concern?
You know, settlement agreements are hard. And I don't envy my client's decision, right? That's settlement agreements are inherently policy determinations. There are some combination of cost control, risk mitigation, and policy decisions. And so whether or not a settlement agreement sets a precedent is really in the eyes of the person speaking. This is a really unique situation. I've been doing this for a long time, Leslie. This lot is one of about a half dozen lots regulated by the Sweeney MPD, associated plat amendments, and an associated subdivision approval. It's an oversimplification to say, this is an old town lot and it should be treated like an old town property. That's not what the Planning Commission found. That's not what the planning director found. And it's what the Board of Adjustment was divided on deciding. And so will it set a precedent? People can certainly assert that it does insofar as every settlement agreement sets a precedent. But here we have a unique property with a unique request and unique regulatory history.
So are there any guardrails in place to ensure that this approach can't become playbook for future applicants?
Well, like I said, there's around a half dozen lots covered by the Sweeney MPD, the Sweeney plat amendments, and the Sweeney subdivision approval. They're not all visible in the same way from Old Town. And so, you know, this may be unique. And if it is, it doesn't set a precedent that is meaningful in terms of its impact on development in and adjacent to Old Town.
So if it is the city's position that the project complies with the applicable regulations, how do you reconcile that with the earlier staff reports, which identified compliance issues, and with the Board of Adjustments decision, again, finding noncompliance based in part on expert analysis?
Yeah, so let's back up. This proposal started in 2022. Mm-hmm. The proposal has gone through a lot of iterations. The property owner has worked with the planning department and the boards and commissions to evolve their design. So for example, there's been a lot of talk about an SWCA report, and those are historic specialists who opined on a 2023 iteration of the project. Some of those staff reports you're referring to were related to different versions of the project. And again, as this iterated and planning staff did more research, so did their analysis and their recommendations.
So is the city saying that those earlier assessments were mistaken, or are you saying that the project has been modified to address those issues? And if so, what are those significant changes to the mass, scale, height, and footprint?
Well, I think the answer is yes, but I need to understand your question better. What are you referring to when you say those decisions or those recommendations were wrong? Which recommendations?
Well, the assessments that were made during the planning process through the Board of Appeals and through the Planning Commission.
Well, again, the project has evolved, and as staff dug in to the Sweeney MPD and all of the associated regulations, their recommendations evolved. So, for example, when they looked at lots 3, 4, 6, and 7 in the Sweeney MPD, which have already been developed, and they looked at those approvals, they learned that those have significant underground parking and tunnels that were not counted toward the footprint. And that same precedent applied here. And so that helped them evaluate this proposal in the appropriate regulatory context.
Speaking of tunnels, any concern by that? I mean, we know that there's about 1,000 miles of mine tunnels underneath Old Town Park City. They are from here to the Ontario, you know, judge mine.
That's a great question for Dave Thacker, the building official.
Okay. So, like you, I received a copy of the letter to the mayor and city council from the Fredston's Hermes attorney, Eric Lee. He writes to the council to not approve the agreement for several reasons. Again, most importantly, because the agreement, he says, won't resolve the pending court appeals. He says that Pesky's apartments are flawed and their effort to, quote, skew the decision-making process with financial inducements is improper, end quote, there. And again, he notes that the district court court in 2 weeks is poised to rule on the merits of the appeals approving the agreement. You know, I mean, so it just, he's saying that, you know, by doing this, you're just multiplying the litigation and undermining procedural fairness and exposing the city to further legal risk. That doesn't sound good. I mean, why not just wait and let the court do its job?
That's the hard question council is going to have to decide on Thursday. And I appreciate the concerns raised. I don't think that council is laboring under the belief that the consent agreement will fully and finally resolve all litigation. Look, we have two property owners who share a property line who disagree about how the regulatory overlay and the regulatory environment should be applied to a specific proposal. This is primarily a dispute between two private parties, and the city is unfortunately stuck in the middle. So, you know, there's a narrative out there, and I think it's in the letter that you just referenced, that the council should support the Board of Adjustment. But yet there isn't a narrative that the council should support the Planning Commission and the Appeal Panel. We've got three different boards that approved or that reviewed somewhat overlapping regulations and their application to this project, and they resulted in somewhat contradictory outcomes. So the city as the regulator stuck in the middle, and what the council's being asked to consider is whether to enter into this consent agreement to shift some of the city's risk in defending these somewhat contradictory approvals away from the city and toward the private properties who are primarily involved in this dispute.
I think what they're asking is that the city council should support the judicial process that we have.
And, you know, again, that hearing on the 29th is partially about the private dispute that the city's not involved in. So that will go forward. Consent agreement wouldn't impact that if it were approved. And then the other part of that hearing on the 29th is about the Herman's request to the district court to overturn the Planning Commission's decision that was upheld by the appeals panel. The decision on the HDDR approval, which is what the Board of Adjustment weighed in on, hasn't been briefed. It hasn't been scheduled for oral argument. And candidly, we don't think a court would consider that until this fall at the soonest. So it's a good question, and it's the one that council's going to have to decide on Thursday.
Okay. I'm going to finish beating that horse. In work session, Heather, staff needs some direction from City Council on the Senior Center. Getting this built is a goal of not only re-elected Council Members Tanah Tolley, but also Mayor Ryan Dickey. Senior Center President Liz Novak stepped down after her term ended. So who's negotiating with Council now?
You know, we've been working with kind of the seniors as a group, mm-hmm. and they have been really involved in helping us design this senior center and working with Sperano and Mooney. And the council is going to be asked during the work session, as you mentioned, to really hone in on the budget for this project, give us some direction on the parking approach, underground versus above ground, or some combination of both, the number of parking stalls, the amount of open space, and in particular, the building size and footprint.
So in November, there were four options. I read that the council preferred option number three. So are there any changes to that, or do we have to look at that again?
You know, we're kind of presenting that option in the context of the 7,500 square foot footprint that the council was interested in pursuing at that last meeting. So we're presenting four options for discussion with the council on Thursday. And that includes that 7,500 square foot footprint, but also concerns in the interests of the seniors in terms of the building programming that they would like to see. And some options with respect to parking, because including underground parking obviously increases the cost quite a bit.
Sure does. And I think what option three said was 47 stalls, no underground parking. How does that compare with what's at the Senior Center now?
There are currently 47 surface parking stalls. So the options that we presented, the first couple of options that we'll be considering on Thursday include quite a bit of underground parking that results in 68 to 69 stalls. And then we have an option that's fewer stalls, which is option four, just on the surface with quite a bit more open space.
Okay, open space, as you mentioned, a consideration. I've kind of asked this all along, does that beautiful longleaf cottonwood that provides hours of fun for kids remain in all of these plans? I mean, right now it looks like it's coming down for parking.
you know, we knew that you'd be interested in the commentary, Leslie. You know, with respect to these options, it will really depend on what the council decides to go forward with. If they choose one of the options that has quite a bit more parking, in terms of a strategy for parking in that area, that may come down. If they choose an option that is fewer stalls, then it may survive.
Okay. Let's see, the price tag above $17 million for option three. How do we pay for that?
You know, that is going to be an ongoing discussion. You know, we have some money earmarked for this project that I believe is in the $9 to $10 million range. But we're also considering what other options we might have, and that will be very much dictated by what the council would like to do and hopefully eventually a county contribution.
Okay. And have those discussions with the county started?
They have begun, and they're in process. We're certainly at the preliminary stages there.
Okay. I know you need to run to a meeting. So anything else you wanted to mention, Heather, before you
just really off? Quickly wanted to mention that we have Sundance coming up, begins on the 22nd. Main Street will be pedestrian only for the first 5 days. We've got express bus service from Richardson Flat to Old Town every 20 minutes during the festival from 6 a.m. to 2 a.m. And we encourage everybody to check out the Park City Community Guide for details on street closures and traffic impacts.
All right, Heather, I appreciate that. Margaret, I'm hoping you can stay a few minutes longer just to quickly go through the council set to make an appointment to City Council. This all has to be done in an open meeting, both the interviews yesterday and then tomorrow's appointment. When other personnel issues are discussed, you know, about a person's character, they can be discussed behind closed doors. So what makes this different?
Great question. So there's an open meeting exception to discuss the character, fitness, or professional competence of an individual. That does not apply when filling a vacancy. And that's a policy determination governed by state law. I think it's founded in the idea that this is fundamentally different than the hiring of, say, a city attorney or a city manager. This is someone who will effectively sit in the seat of an elected official. And so the legislature requires that process to be conducted fully an open meeting without any closed meeting allowed.
So we see it all the time on TV. I mean, to skirt an open meeting issue, I mean, in real life, can council members, though, just talk one-to-one privately as long as it's just the two of them, say, coffee or on the ski slopes?
There's nothing in the Open Meetings Act that prohibits, you know, one-on-one conversations to help council members, you know, think through their policy decisions. We do discourage them from having meetings outside the meeting, right? Circumventing the spirit of the Open Meetings Act is tempting, but I think we've got a good group that really wants to conduct the public's business appropriately and in open meetings, and I assume that's what they're going to do here.
So if council members were to text or email their thoughts about the applicants, I mean, would media be able to grab those texts and emails?
You can grandma anything you want. The question is always whether or not it's a public record. And, you know, discussions about the public's business, unless there's something protecting it, they are public records and would be provided under grandma.
Yeah. Do council members have their own cell phones or do they carry official cell phones? Elected.
Their answer is, I don't know, but it doesn't matter. The device isn't determinative. And by that, I mean, the question is whether or not the discussion is about the public's business. If it's about the public's business and there's not a protection for the substance of the discussion, then it's a public record. So you can use your personal device. That doesn't convert it to being shielded from a records request.
Or your personal email as well.
Correct.
Right? Okay. All right. Also, legislative platform will be reviewed. We talked a little bit with Senator Ron Winterton, who it sounds like he's got your back in terms of, you know, helping you to, you know, kind of ward off anything like we have seen in the past. But I mean, what do you know about this year's session so far?
Yeah, no, I appreciated your conversation with Senator Winterton very much. I appreciated his comments about local control and him being a local government guy. So what do we know about this session? You know, it's some of what he said in terms of what we expect. We think there'll be an ongoing focus on land use regulations. That's a perpetual subject of discussion down at the Capitol. Building and development codes, housing and affordability. And you heard, again, about transportation infrastructure, especially as Summit County and the Wasatch Back looks towards 2024. So we expect all of those to come up this session.
All right. And who are your eyes on the ground?
Well, Councilmember Tolley is on the board of the Utah League of Cities and Towns, so we're really happy to have that Wasatch Back representation And then she and Mayor Dickey and I will sort of be the core legislative team, assisted by Michelle Downard, whose title now is the Strategic Initiatives Advisor. And she helps us track all the bills, sort of get input internally from all the different departments to make sure that we're following things appropriately. We also have a lot of city staff like Dave Thacker, the building official, Chief Carpenter, me, you know, and others who are involved with professional organizations that specifically watch things that impact our areas of expertise. And so we all coordinate on that internally.
All right. And you also have a lobbyist?
We also have a lobbyist, correct.
And who's that?
Dave Stewart is the lobbyist for Park City and has been for a long time. He's fantastic.
All right. And does the city have a public tracker? You mentioned the internally you have one, but is that a public document?
Yeah, we'll post a tracker that sort of highlights the bills that we're following. But public trackers are better. You know, the Utah League of Cities and Towns has a fantastic bill tracker that is way more robust than we have the bandwidth to do. So if folks are interested in looking at what's impacting local government and what bills are out there, I recommend going to ULCT's website and following their bill tracker.
Okay. And once again, I mean, is this another just this Park City being on the defense?
No. We're also proactive. We've got a great group. We've got Tana Tolley on the board. We've got Mayor Dickey. We've got me. We've got others who are involved. And we, you know, work with our respective professional organizations to, if there's something we see should be changed or tweaked, we're working on those. We work on those all year.
Margaret, anything else you wanted to mention?
I just appreciate your time, Leslie. Thanks.
Thank you. Margaret Plain serves as Park City's attorney. Well, the Park City Council has now interviewed the 10 candidates vying for the seat that Ryan Dickey left to become mayor. Yesterday, the council asked each candidate 5 predetermined questions, including why the candidate wants to serve on the Park City Council and their previous experience. Other questions were about policy, including how candidates would balance growth with open space and the city's role in addressing housing affordability. The full interviews are available online at a link at kpcw.org. The Park City Council will appoint Dickey's replacement at its regular meeting tomorrow at City Hall. The new council member will be sworn in January 20th and fill the seat until the unexpired term ends in January 2028. Well, the South Summit School District says it planned ahead for a positive measles case to minimize student and staff impacts. KPCW's Connor Thomas has more on how quarantined students are going to keep up with their schoolwork.
South Summit Elementary School students quarantining after a potential measles exposure January 5th will use printed learning packets to study at home. South Summit Superintendent Greg Mond tells KPCW that video conferencing technology used during the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic won't work in this case.
During COVID, if you experienced trying to teach online and trying to teach in person at the same time, it's really not possible. It's not feasible. So teachers are certainly willing and wanting to work with students and parents as much as we can to try to help keep the kids current and prevent them from getting behind.
Teachers prepared the learning packets before Summit County's first positive measles case was confirmed this year. Mond says the school district has been planning its response with the Summit County Department of Health, staff, and parents since the end of the summer.
That we were able to start getting documents, you know, as far as people's immunization documentation and things, which really helped because the number would have been a lot higher than what it was.
The superintendent now says about 20 students and a few staff are staying home since being exposed. The quarantine period is 3 weeks, so they'll be able to return to school Monday, January 26th. Those who have received doses of the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine have not had to stay home. Health experts say one dose is 93% effective at preventing measles infections and 97% effective after 2 doses. Symptoms of measles usually begin 7 to 14 days after exposure and can include a cough, high fever, and red itchy rash. Complications of the virus can be life-threatening. Mon adds that the County Health Department has also been meeting with the North Summit and Park City School Districts since the summer to plan for measles. The case identified at South Summit Elementary was Summit County's only confirmed case as of January 13th. Overall, the State Health Department says at least 199 cases of measles have been diagnosed statewide since June 2025. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
And a heads up for those of you who want to participate in the final Sundance Film Festival here in Park City. Individual film tickets go on sale this morning at 10 a.m. Locals and visitors can purchase single tickets for $35 each this year. Tickets to see films in person are available for screenings both weeks of the festival from Thursday, January 22nd through Sunday, February 1st. Online screens begin January 29th with those tickets available through February 1st. All in-person ticket packages for the last festival in Utah sold out. Again, the Sundance Film Festival moving to Boulder, Colorado starting next year.